Good evening, everyone. Hi, my name is Brady. I'm a follower of Jesus, and it was really fun to have the Zach Olson trio with us tonight. That's Zach Olson. He is the head of all of our worship leaders at Mosaic, and so it's really fun to have him periodically. If you were here last week, though, you got to hear Carrie Ann speak, and that was so fun and just unbelievably challenging to simplify our lives. The reason that we did that is because we are going through this year the disciplines of the faith, or you may have heard them called spiritual disciplines, and what those are just the means that God has given us to cultivate intimacy with him. If you want to know how you can have a deeper, more full, more intimate relationship with God, the disciplines of the faith are the way that we're called to do that. It's just the lifestyle that Jesus lived. He lived a lifestyle of intimacy with the Father and with the Spirit, and there were things that he did that cultivated that. And so as followers of Jesus, those who are trying to follow in his footsteps, we try to do that as well. And so once a month, we will go through a different discipline of the faith. So yeah, last week was simplicity. I've been trying to simplify my life in a few different ways this year, and so video media has been one of them. I'm trying not to watch any personal video media because it is a waste of my time most of the time, unless it's, I guess, uplifting or whatever I'm learning something from it or whatever. Anyway, but what that has done, and it just I'm just gonna be real with you, it's created some space in my life. Because the time that I would be watching something, I'm not watching something. So that's just, there's time there. And it's one thing to think, okay, I'm going to get rid of something. And then it's a whole nother thing to think, what do I do now? Because I don't know. Sometimes it's you get bored. Have you ever been bored before? Before maybe you ever had a phone, maybe you got bored back in the day. It's just not a thing anymore. As soon as you feel like the sensation that you might possibly be bored, you have games at your fingertips and videos at your fingertips and people at your fingertips. It's so quick. And so I've just kind of realized that I've been bored. And so I started doing this really novel thing. I started reading the news. Yeah, I have 3 news apps on my phone now, so I've started reading the news, which in some ways is fun, but in other ways, man, the world is depressing, is it not? Have you ever done that, read the news before, and just kind of got depressed because there's just all kind of conflict going on? There are wars going on all over the world. There's terrorism going on all over the world. There are trade embargoes, and there's, you know, the building up of nuclear weapons. There's, you know, all kind of disagreements all over the world. And it's easy to think, man, the world is a messed up place. It's easy to be here, sitting here in America, and look at the world and say, you guys are screwed up. You guys don't know how to deal with conflict. And then I think, oh, well, I've been reading some American news too. And I don't know if you know this, but America's kind of polarized right now. Have you heard the latest news? We're polarized on a couple of different issues. We're polarized on gun control. We're polarized on abortion. We're polarized on Republicans, Democrats. We're polarized on fill in the blank, whether we should build a wall between us and Mexico or not, or, you know, what immigration rules we should have. We're polarized on so many things in our country, and it's crazy. We're polarized on race. We're polarized on sexism and gender and identity, all these kind of things. We're just so polarized, and we're just fighting each other so much. We're angry a lot. And it can be really easy sitting here in a church, Holiday Inn, whatever, and kind of look at America and think, man, America's screwed up. But I tell you what, you know, Catholic versus Protestant, we've got Calvinist versus Arminius, we've got charismatic versus cessationist, we've got all kind of stuff going on within the church. In fact, so often, if you ask someone what they think about when they think about Christianity or when they think about Christians, probably they think about, we argue about stupid stuff. We argue about things that don't matter. We get so passionately and vehemently opposed to one another on things that aren't that important. At least they don't seem that important to the rest of the world. We're known more as Christians for what we're against than what we're actually for. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of conflict going on, and we don't always deal with it well. Now, I want to give an example in case you're not already with me. Can you throw up that image? What do all of these celebrities have in common? Anybody know? What do they all have in common? They have a person in common. Who is it? It's Taylor Swift. They all have Taylor Swift in common. They do. They do. Now here's the deal. Every single one of these people on this screen have had some form of feud with Taylor Swift, whether it be a gigantic one or a small one. Now, here's the thing. I don't know what has gone on in all of this stuff. None of us know what has gone on, but we've all heard. We've heard the stuff that has gone on, and the media, you know, blows it out of proportion, I'm sure. But here's basically what happens. There's a conflict, right, with one of these people, whether, you know, they were dating and it was a breakup, or they were friends and there was kind of a falling out, or, you know, someone felt left out because, you know, we were squadding up on stuff, or fill in the blank, something happened, and then there was people forming up their own squads, then there were interviews that took place, then there were Twitter back and forth stuff that happened, and then there were some songs, and some songs, and some more songs that were written about all of this stuff that went down. Now, I am not saying all of this stuff. I'm not bringing this up, all of the feuds that Taylor Swift has had, to throw shade on Taylor Swift. I really am not. I'm just hoping that maybe she'll hear this and write a song about me. So just, that's kind of what I'm going for here. No, that's not what I'm doing. What I wanted to use was a very public example that all of us except for Lynn, all of us, for the most part, know what's going on in this. It's not like, it's not behind closed doors. It's not something that people are shocked by. Like we know. And I want to use this as an example of something that we all do. Like, we can look at Taylor Swift and we can say, oh man, you fight with everybody. And you fight in the worst ways. But I tell you what, we do the exact same stuff. Or we have some sort of conflict, throw out some catty comments, squad up. We got to get our people, right? We got to get our people on our side that know our side of the story, that are with us, so that they can be against them when the time comes when we need them. And then we use social media and we backstab and we do passive aggressive things. And that's kind of how we handle conflict a lot of times in our world, especially in the world of social media. Like, we are not immune to this. That's us. This is how we do it. And I tell you what, Jesus has some really incredible things to say to the way that we handle conflict in relationships. Go ahead and grab your Bible or the book of Matthew. Maybe that was on your chair. This is a book in the Bible. It's the first book in the New Testament. And if you're not familiar with the Bible, it's split up into two parts. There's the Old Testament, which was the Jewish scriptures. So it kind of had the history of God and the Jewish people and Israel. And then we have the New Testament, which is on the heels of when Jesus was born, when he came, and it's you have the Gospels about his life, and then we have some letters written after that that kind of look back on Jesus and his life and try to explain it. And this is the book of Matthew. This is the first gospel or historical account of Jesus' life. We've been in the book of Matthew for a while. Go ahead and turn to chapter 5. And what chapter 5 is the beginning of one of Jesus' most famous teachings called the Sermon on the Mount. This is one of his most famous teachings. And I was thinking about this today. And I heard that this quote, and it made me think of this idea, this thought about what we are getting to hear as we listen to the Sermon on the Mount. This is the heartbeat of God. Have you ever like listened to someone else's heartbeat? Every once in a while, I'll listen to the heartbeat of my dog. I mean, someone else told me they do that. But there's something like neat about listening to someone else's heartbeat. Like, there's something intimate about that. There's something that draws you near about that. There's something, I don't know, something unique about that. The Sermon on the Mount is God's heartbeat. It's God, through Jesus, his son, saying, hey, this is what my kingdom needs to look like. This is what my citizens are going to be like. This is what my sons and my daughters, this is how they're going to act. This is how they're going to treat each other. This is how they're going to treat the world. This is the heartbeat of God. So as you read the Sermon on the Mount, you get to see a beautiful picture of God's incredible heart. Now, Jesus has been starting out by blessing some incredible people. This is amazing about the Sermon on the Mount. It starts with Jesus saying, hey, all of you who don't have what it takes spiritually, blessed are you. You're welcome. You're welcome in my kingdom. And then he talks to those who are mourning, who are brokenhearted. And then he talks to those that are powerless and oppressed. And then he talks to those who don't have any righteousness on their own, but yet want it, that long for it, that hunger for it. He talks about the pure in heart. And today he says this, verse 8, he says, blessed, this is Jesus talking, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons, and we could also put in daughters of God. They shall be called the children of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. There's a lot there. I want to just remind us once again that first word, blessed, it's not a word that translates well into English. This is a word that is used that when Jesus speaks it, he is actually speaking something into existence. To all of these people, he is actually speaking blessing on them, and something is happening. Like, those people that Jesus is describing are receiving the blessing from Jesus, which is so awesome. The second thing that is happening is this word is a congratulations. So you might say this to someone who got the job of their dreams. You might say this to someone who just got really good news. You say, congratulations. Your circumstance or your situation that you're living in is such that I should congratulate you. And the last way is that it's not that your circumstance is that great, but it's that your perspective is so amazing, it's so transcendent that I want to say you're blessed, that in spite of your circumstances, your perspective has given you joy. It's given you this incredible life, this abundant life, and so you are blessed. So when Jesus speaks this, he's saying a lot there. And he says, blessed are the peacemakers. Peacemakers. That's an interesting word, isn't it? Peacemakers. When I think of peacemaker, and you may not think about this, I think of a revolver that was used in the West, in the Wild Wild West, you know, in the days of yore and yesteryear and of old, right? You know, back if you ever watch a cowboy movie, the basic gun, the pistol that they use when is called a peacemaker. Which I'm guessing that's not what Jesus had in mind. He was saying, blessed are the peacemakers, right? Right? He's not saying, blessed are those that have a gun that can, quote unquote, make peace. That's not what he's saying. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. Now, when I think about peacemakers, I think of conflict. I immediately think of some sort of relational dynamic where there is conflict. Now, we typically, in our society, in our culture, we typically handle conflict in one of three ways, three major ways. The first way is kind of touted by the word tolerance. You've heard the word tolerance before. Tolerance is not necessarily a bad thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. That we should tolerate each other to some extent is really actually a good thing. Rather than when you do something that I don't like, I don't punch you in the face, right? I can tolerate it, right? But what happens so quickly is tolerance turns to apathy. Right? It's not just that I'm gonna have patience with you as a person, as a human being. It's that I don't really care about you as a human being. I just don't care. Like, it's not worth it for me to engage in this. Whatever you're doing, whatever you're thinking, however you're acting, whether it's hurting you or hurting other people or hurting me, I just don't care enough about you to even engage in that, even enter into that, even say anything. It's just not worth it to me. I believe that if you begin to evaluate your heart in places where you were tolerant, I imagine there's a seed of apathy in there, a seed of you don't really care enough about that person to engage in a way that I would call loving, what is good and helpful and beneficial for that person. Now, there's a bumper sticker that I've seen a lot. It's called Coexist. Have you ever seen that? Go ahead and throw that up there. Have you ever seen the Coexist? And the idea behind this, and I'm just going to pretend that the person who invented this had a really pure heart. I don't know what they were thinking. But saying that, hey, there's a lot that religion has done that has caused wars and people to fight against each other and kill each other. Can't we just kind of get along a little bit? And I think there's some good in that. But as soon as it becomes apathy, as soon as it's, I don't care about you, you can think what you want, do what you want, say what you want, it doesn't affect me, and I don't care enough about you to engage. That's when it's not good. That's when it's not healthy. That's when it's not beneficial. We should have conversations. We should engage in relationship with people. People of different faiths. People that think differently than us. People that look differently than us. People that act differently than us. We should have good, awesome, encouraging, grace-filled conversations with people. That's important to do. Don't be apathetic. That's not being a peacemaker. The second thing is this idea of escalation, of self-righteous indignation. I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but in our society, there's a tiny group of people that get easily offended. I don't know, that happens like every once in a while. Sometimes somebody will get really easily offended. And usually it's spurred on by this self-righteous indignation. It's I've been offended. You know, you've stepped on my rights. You've stepped on my pride or whatever. I'm going to escalate it. I'm going to escalate the conflict so that I can win, so that I can assert my rights. I can assert my way. I can assert my opinion and my status. Now, I came across this meme that I thought was really pretty good. We throw that up there? Trying to avoid offending someone in 2018. It's like going through the laser maze, right? It's today in our culture, in our society, it's really hard not to offend people, isn't it? Maybe, maybe not. It feels like it for me. On social media, people get, we have this, oh goodness, bless our community. I live in this housing development that has a Facebook page. And on that Facebook page, people fight and get offended about everything. And then it escalates and it's crazy. It's amazing. I mean, this happens all the time, especially with social media. Now, millennials get blamed for this a lot. You know, can I have an amen on that one? Do you get blamed for being easily offended? You know there's a show on television on CBS called The Great Indoors? I don't know if it's still on, but it was on at a time. And one of the things that it explored was how millennials are easily offended. And so that actually got a lot of backlash from millennial reporters. They were offended by the show that showed them as being easily offended. Then there was a study done. You've probably heard the word snowflake before, right? Now, snowflake, that's something in the winter in the northern states that happens, and each snowflake is unique and different, right? So, man, being a snowflake is kind of cool. That means you're unique, you're different, you're special, you're beautiful, but it's really taken on a negative connotation. It's really kind of been something that's been thrown out to demean. It's derogatory now. It's that you get easily offended. There was a study done. This is an actual study that was done on the word snowflake. And a majority of the millennials that were in this study believed that this word snowflake referred to them was doing damage to their mental health. Now, here's the thing. Let's just for a second, I want you to know, I don't think you can tell whether millennials are more offended or more easily offended than any other generation. I think that would be impossible to figure out, impossible to measure. There are far too many factors going on. I think it's really a society problem. I think our society, our culture is more easily offended now because we can have a voice. We can tout it on social media. When I was growing up, there were people that had power because they were actually powerful. They were, I don't know, strong and bullies or who knows what. And it just, like, they had power and you couldn't do anything about it. If you were powerful, you had power and you kept it. And if you weren't, you couldn't really do anything about it. But in the age of social media and in the age where we actually care about things like, at least we say we do in our society about sexism and racism and bigotry and bullying, like we really care about that. So if someone does something to you that is more powerful than you and you don't have the power to stand up for them, if you post it on social media, you have immediate power. Because everyone comes to your rescue, right? And there's a side of this that is good. I think it's good for people to band together against things that are not okay. But I think we've kind of, maybe it's subconscious, maybe it's consciously, we've realized that there's power to be had in being offended. And so as soon as we want some power, we get offended, and then we have some power. But this isn't the way that Jesus blesses. Blessed are those who have self-righteous indignation, who are easily offended, who escalate it, who assert their rights and their way. That's not what Jesus said. And the last way that we typically do this is avoidance. This is based out of fear. We're afraid. We're afraid of what might happen in the conflict. We're afraid of what happen after the conflict. We're afraid of conflict, and so we avoid conflict. We just kind of, it's like, I'm just going to walk on eggshells around this person. I'm going to stick to the status quo. I'm just going to just keep things as they are. I don't want to upset the balance of power. I'm afraid to engage, and so I avoid conflict. And I'm really glad that High School Musical spoke to this, right? Don't stick to the stuff that we know, right? Don't stick to the status quo. Isn't that something like that? It was great. I get why that movie was so wildly popular, because for years, you might not understand this because you didn't grow up in this time, is like the status quo, at least in high school and junior high, like it was legit and it was set in stone. If you were an athlete, you were up here, and if you weren't, you were down here. Right? If you were beautiful, you were up here, and if not, you were down here, and you had nothing. And it was rough. I'm really glad that things have begun to change in our society. Not completely, but begun to change. But still, right? To be apathetic, to assert our, you know, self-righteousness, or to avoid. This is not what Jesus blesses. Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the peacemakers. What is Jesus saying here? Blessed are the peacemakers. Here's something that Frederick Dale Bruner said in his incredible commentary on Matthew. He says this: many commentators notice that Jesus does not bless only peace-loving or peace-wanting, which can remain passive, or even peace-living, which can remain individual, but peace-making, which is active and social and involves other people. Peacemaking, it's active, it's social, it involves other people. Martin, I cannot get enough of D. Martin Lloyd Jones, just because that name. I love it. The Lego Ninja movie is too good. He says this: before one can be a peacemaker, one really must be entirely delivered from self. Self-interest, self-concern. Uh-oh, how are we doing? You must not be sensitive. You guys all right? Okay, you must not be sensitive. You must not be touchy. You must not be on the defensive. If you are, you will not be a very good peacemaker. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, not who are apathetic, not who are passive, not who are afraid, and not who are, you know, like going in to win. The peacemakers will go into conflict appropriately with love, actively towards other people. But if you're going to do that, you have to be delivered from yourself. It can't be all about you, or you're going to be in trouble. If you're touchy, if you're sensitive, if you get defensive really easily, it's going to be difficult for you to be a peacemaker. Now, this is what Jesus talks about here, what it means to be a peacemaker. This is incredible. And I want to throw a smattering of scriptures out to you to really kind of paint this picture. Numbers 5:5-7 says this: and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel. When a man or woman commits any of the sins that people committed by breaking that people commit by breaking faith with the Lord, and that person realizes his guilt, he shall confess his sin that he has committed, and he shall make full restitution for his wrong. Get this, adding a fifth to it and giving it to him to whom he did the wrong. God says, if you wrong someone, if you hurt someone, if you steal something from someone, if you damage their property, if you do something to someone to damage the relationship between you two, you need to go, you the one who broke it, you the one who did something, go in, make full restitution, and then some. That's what Jesus is talking about when he says peacemakers. It's not just make restitution, it's go further than that, add a fifth more. That's what the law was in the Old Testament. In Matthew 5:5-7, it says, and the Lord spoke, 7:3-5, it says, why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there's a log in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. This is what the way I boil it down. When you're having conflict with someone, when there's someone who you think has sinned against you, you think of your sin first, and you think of your sin as worse. your sin first, and your sin is worse. Theirs is a speck, yours is a log, and you take care of yours first. Matthew 5, 23 through 24. If you are offering your gift at the altar, this is worshiping God, okay? If you're worshiping God, and there you remember that your brother or your sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift to God. If you're worshiping God, and you remember somebody has something against you, stop. Stop it. Go be reconciled first, and then go worship God. That's what it means to be a peacemaker. Matthew 5, 25, come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're going with him to court. Man, on the way to court, make peace with somebody. Matthew 5, 40 through 41, if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Don't just do what is required of you. Don't just do what you have to do. Go beyond that. Be a peacemaker. Restore the relationship. Go above and beyond. And here's what it says in Romans, and this is so beautiful. Romans 12, 18 and verse 21, it says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Now, as far as it depends on you, this phrase is brilliant. There's two things in here. One is you need to go as far as you possibly can. Right? As far as it depends on you, anything that you can do to restore relationship, to reconcile the relationship, to restore peace, as far as it depends on you, do that thing, whatever it is. But at the same time, be set free from their reaction. Be set free from the result. Right? You might not be able to create a harmonious environment with this other person because they might not let you. And that's okay. Be free in that. Do what you can, and then you can let it go. That's okay. You don't have to be enslaved to their reaction, enslaved to the result of the conflict. But as far as it depends on you, and this is brilliant. Do not be overcome by evil, but instead overcome evil with good. See, peacemaking is one of the few offensive weapons that we have. I feel so often I'm just being bombarded by sin and difficulty and stuff. And it's just whatever I can do to be defensive and stop it from happening. Jesus says, this is the way that you go out on the offensive. Overcome evil, but overcome it with good. Overcome it with peacemaking. How do we do this? How do we be a peacemaker? There's a lot to it. But first, I just want to key in on this phrase that Jesus says at the end. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God, or the sons of God, or the daughters of God. 1 John 3:1 says this, see what great love the Father has lavished on us. He has lavished on us that we should be called the children of God, and that is what we are. How incredible that God, the God of the universe, would call us, would refer to us, would think of us and treat us like children, like his sons, like his daughters, his kiddos. I mean, that's what he thinks about us. That's how he feels towards us. Those who are peacemakers, who act in the way that Jesus is talking about, who treat like that, you're the sons and daughters of God. You will be called the sons and daughters of God. Now, there was this phrase is pretty big in that day and age. There was one person who was called the Son of God and one person who was called the bringer of peace on earth. Who was that? It wasn't at the time. It was Caesar. See, Caesar had brought peace to the nation of Rome. I know it's shocking that the one question, the answer is always Jesus. I know, in church. But I pulled a fast one on you. It's Caesar. Yeah, Caesar, one of his gigantic claims was this. One, that he was the Son of God. That he was divinity himself. And secondly, that he was the one that had brought peace to the earth. And maybe it felt like peace to Caesar, because he wasn't having to do a lot of war at the time. But for you, in your society, in your situation, when you were being oppressed by Rome, it didn't feel a whole lot like peace. And Jesus says, no, all of you people, poor in spirit, mourning, brokenhearted, you who are peacemakers, you are the sons and the daughters of God. Man, how countercultural was that? Now, if you're like me and you hear about all of this stuff, it seems really hard. Beyond hard. It seems impossible. This is why I love Jesus. Isaiah 52:7. This is a prophecy about the Messiah or the anointed king who would come to redeem and restore all things. It's a prophecy about Jesus. And it says, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace, who brings good news of happiness, who publishes salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. How beautiful are the feet who bring this message of peace, that God reigns. This was Jesus. Colossians 1:19 through 20 says this, for in Jesus all of the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. How did Jesus reconcile all things to himself? How did Jesus make peace? Was he apathetic? Did he stand? Did he just not care enough? I mean, like, whatever, they're humans. I'm God. What does it matter? Right? I mean, like, why should I care? Was he asserting his self-righteous indignation? You offended me. You were my enemies. I'm just going to crush you. Was he afraid to enter into the conflict, enter into the difficulty, enter into the muck and the mire? No. Jesus put on flesh. Here's how it says it in Philippians chapter 2, 5 through 8. Think of yourselves the way Christ Jesus thought of himself. He had equal status with God, but he didn't think so much of himself that he had to cling to the advantages of that status no matter what. Not at all. When the time came, he set aside the privileges of deity. And he took on the status of a slave and became human. Having become human, he stayed human. It was an incredibly humbling process. He didn't claim special privileges. Instead, he lived a selfless, obedient life and then died a selfless, obedient death, and the worst kind of death at that, a crucifixion. Jesus didn't stand far off in apathy. He wasn't afraid of what it would take. Instead, he came down. The God of the universe set aside his rights to divinity, became human, and then bore all of our sin upon his shoulders and died for us on a cross so that we could be restored into relationship with him, so that we could be reconciled to God, so that we wouldn't have to be far off from God. We wouldn't have to be his enemies. We could be his children, his sons and his daughters. Ones that he loves so deeply, so dearly, so fully, so completely. This is the love of God. It's a love of peacemaking, going into the difficulty, going into the conflict, and making peace through self-sacrifice and humility. Peacemakers are humble. Those are the footsteps of Jesus. Here's what Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, said about this. He says, only the man or woman who is reconciled with God can also be reconciled and in harmony with him or herself. And only the man who is reconciled with God and with himself can establish peace around him throughout the world. It feels impossible, doesn't it? To live that life that Jesus talked about, to live that life that Jesus demonstrated. Yeah, we can't do it apart from being reconciled to God by Jesus. But what Jesus does, when he reconciles us, he takes our heart of stone and he gives us a heart of flesh. Right? He makes us a brand new creation and he fills us with his spirit so we now can live that life walking in Jesus' footsteps, following him into the world to bring peace to the world. Now it's better than that. It's even better than that because the word peace that we have falls so short. I want you to watch this video by the Bible Project. It really does a great example of showing what this word peace means.
The word peace is common in most languages. People can talk about peace treaties or times of peace. It means the absence of war. And in the Bible, the word peace can refer to the absence of conflict, but it also points to the presence of something better in its place. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for peace is shalom. And in the New Testament, the Greek word is eirene. The most basic meaning of shalom is complete, or hole. The word can refer to a stone that has a perfect whole shape with no cracks. It can also refer to a completed stone wall that has no gaps and no missing bricks. Shalom refers to something that's complex with lots of pieces that's in a state of completeness, wholeness. It's like Job, who says his tents are in a state of shalom because he counted his flock and no animals are missing. This is why shalom can refer to a person's well-being. Like when David visited his brothers on the battlefield, he asked about their shalom. The core idea is that life is complex, full of moving parts and relationships and situations, and when any of these is out of alignment or missing, your shalom breaks down. Life is no longer whole, it needs to be restored. In fact, that's the basic meaning of shalom when you use it as a verb. To bring shalom literally means to make complete or restore. So Solomon brings shalom to the unfinished temple when he completes it. Or if your animal accidentally damages your neighbor's field, you shalom them by giving them a complete repayment for their loss. You take what's missing and you restore it to wholeness. The same goes for human relationships. In the book of Proverbs, to reconcile and heal a broken relationship is to bring shalom. And when rival kingdoms make shalom in the Bible, it doesn't just mean they stop fighting, it also means they start working together for each other's benefit. This state of shalom is what Israel's kings were supposed to cultivate, and it rarely happened. So the prophet Isaiah, he looked forward to a future king, a prince of shalom, and his reign would bring shalom with no end. A time when God would make a covenant of shalom with his people and make right all wrongs and heal all that's been broken. This is why Jesus' birth in the New Testament was announced as the arrival of Eirene. Remember, that's the Greek word for peace. Jesus came to offer his peace to others, like when he said to his followers, "My peace I give to you all." The apostles claimed that Jesus made peace between messed up humans and God when he died and rose from the dead. The idea is that he restored to wholeness the broken relationship between humans and their creator. This is why the Apostle Paul can say Jesus himself is our Eirene. He was the whole complete human that I am made to be but have failed to be. And now he gives me his life as a gift. And this means that Jesus' followers are now called to create peace. Paul instructed local churches to keep their unity through the bond of peace, which requires humility and patience and bearing with others in love. Becoming people of peace means participating in the life of Jesus, who reconciled all things in heaven on earth, restoring peace through his death and resurrection. So peace takes a lot of work, because it's not just the absence of conflict. True peace requires taking what's broken and restoring it to wholeness, whether it's in our lives, our relationships, or in our world. And that's the rich biblical concept of peace.
See, that's beautiful. Man, that peace is worth talking about. That peace is a kind of life that's worth living. That kind of peace is a peace that surpasses all comprehension, as Paul says in Philippians. Shalom. And what happens when we, followers of Jesus, in response to what God has done for us, when we spread shalom, we spread the kingdom of God. We actively spread the kingdom of God as we restore relationships, as we reconcile relationships. I believe if you could boil the Bible down into one word, it would be reconciliation. God is reconciling the world, and he's using us to be a part of that reconciliation process. And the way that we do that is we war against our natural tendency to apathy and instead view every other person as an image bearer of God worthy of engaging with. We fight against our ingrained habit of being easily offended and instead humble ourselves and submit ourselves to one another. We fight against our fear of conflict and what may happen. And we instead engage with grace and engage with love.